Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in German Studies. I'm Ryan Stackers. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Astrid Eckert about her new book, West Germany and the Iron Curtain, Environment, Economy, and Culture in the Borderlands. I first had the pleasure of reading Astrid's work with her award-winning Fight for the Files, The Western Allies and Return of Captured German Archives. I am pleased to report, however, that West Germany and the Iron Curtain, available from Oxford University Press as of 2019, is another fascinating contribution to literature. Reviewers are already hailing it as a, quote, brilliant exploration of the economic and environmental peculiarities of the border zone that is essential reading for all students of post-1945 Europe. I, for one, am inclined to agree. Eckert's new study examines how the Iron Curtain altered the economic, social, and ecological conditions regionally with far-reaching implications further afield. But enough from me. We are fortunate enough to have her here with us today. So without further ado, Astrid, welcome to the show.
Hi, hello from Atlanta, and thank you for having me on the podcast.
Well, it's our pleasure. To begin with, what brought you to the study of history?
As an undergrad, I was still under the impression that I would become a journalist, but I always wanted to dig a bit deeper and always needed a bit more space to express myself. So I more and more moved over to the academic side, and eventually went to grad school.
Why history, though? What was it about the methodology or the subject matter? What about the subject was the attraction for you?
Well, I studied in Berlin. I got my degree from Free University Berlin. And I guess as any Berlin visitor could tell you, you walk through town and history is all around you. The Germans, of course, have a very tumultuous 20th century history. And I myself at some point got the feeling that I was living it in 1989. When the wall came down and when Germany really changed profoundly. I was in high school at the time, and it just, you know, you really got sucked into it and you wanted to know more about it.
Well, as you briefly allude to, the story of how you came to write this book involves some very poignant absurdities. The root of the questions seem close to home. Well, I suppose more appropriately, it is home to you. How did you come to write this book specifically?
Yeah, I guess we all have our stories, how we come to write the books we ended up writing. And my story probably begins with a photo from 1985. I was in high school at the time, and teenagers from Paris came to visit my school as part of an exchange program. And we were living in a very small town in the state of Lower Saxony, that's in the north of Germany. And frankly, I mean, we were living in the sticks, right? And I suppose we had a bit of an inferiority complex towards our visitors. What did we have to offer to 15-year-olds from Paris, right? Well, you know, we took them to the Iron Curtain. We probably told them that they would get to see the place where East and West collided. We probably told them that this was a place of global significance. And frankly, I cannot remember what we told them. The visit was perfectly undramatic. There was no world historical dimension to it, but it was just another outing to keep our visitors amused. And I remember this photo from that trip when I started to research on the inter-German border. And growing up, I'd never given much thought to the fact that the country roads ended some half hour to the east. It was the normal state of things. But as I was approaching the subject as a historian, and some 20 years after unification, it dawned on me that I must have grown up in a Cold War borderland, and that my youth was probably more exciting than I'd ever thought. So on a personal level, this book is, as you said, to a certain extent, my effort to understand the absurdities with which I grew up and why I didn't find them absurd back then. And I wanted to study this particular border, not just because of my personal connection to it. I also felt that at a time when new borders go up and existing ones are fortified and dormant ones are revived, it may well be the right moment to historicize the Iron Curtain. I find the Iron Curtain such a compelling subject because, well, you know, it has come and gone. It's noteworthy not only for the extent of its brutality, but also for its disappearance. So here was a real life experiment in partition that could unexpectedly be undone. And that really fascinated me.
Out of everything that you discovered, what is it that you want the reader to walk away thinking about from this book?
Yeah, my book is called West Germany and the Iron Curtain. And the first thing I always point out is that the book is not about the Berlin Wall, right? I mean, if people have any association with the term Iron Curtain, or if they have a mental image of it, it's usually the Berlin Wall. But my book is not about the Berlin situation. Instead, it engages the history of the long inter-German border that meandered mostly through rural areas between West and East Germany. So after 1945, this long border used to be the demarcation line between the British and American zones of military occupation on one side and the Soviet zone of occupation on the other. And as the early Cold War set in and the former World War II allies drifted apart, this demarcation line slowly but surely turned into a real border, right? It became strictly policed, increasingly fortified. And in its most mature stage in the 1970s and 80s, the inter-German border was one of the most militarized borders in the world. So my book examines the consequences of this volatile inter-German border for West Germany. This focus probably needs a brief explanation as well. I mean, projects sometimes begin with a very simple observation. Scholarship on post-war Germany and on post-war Europe more generally has for the most part treated the Iron Curtain as belonging to the history of socialist East Germany, the GDR. And even Edith Schaeffer's very fine micro-study of two adjacent border towns ended up finding the more interesting and the more dramatic stories on the eastern side. She's addressing that in her discussion of her sources. And that makes immediate sense. I mean, the inter-German border and the Berlin Wall proved decisive for the lives of most East Germans. These structures were designed to separate competing ideologies and, of course, to undercut out-migration, if necessary, by deadly force. As Thomas Lindenberger has argued, the ripple effects of the GDR border regime defined the East German dictatorship. They translated into a multitude of boundaries within East German society. So Lindenberger actually classifies the GDR as a dictatorship of borders. And I don't question the centrality of the border regime for the history of the GDR, but I wanted to flip the direction and ask, what did the inter-German border mean for West Germany? In which ways did it matter on the Western side, apart from the obvious fact that it divided the country? And how could I write about this border without reproducing the already familiar narratives that the Iron Curtain is known for, right? I don't think anybody needed another book on escapes from the GDR or on the border's military history. So my book takes a fresh look at the history of the old Federal Republic and the German reunification process from the perspective, from the spatial perspective of the West German borderlands that emerged along this Cold War demarcation line. And the borderlands I'm dealing with are the counties on the western side of the inter-German border. West German contemporaries referred to these border counties as the Zonenrandgebiet, the zonal borderlands. And I wish I could show you a map on this podcast, but imagine a 25-mile deep strip of land along the inter-German border on the western side. So that's the extent of these borderlands. And my central argument is tied to this 25-mile deep strip. The book argues that these border regions were the most sensitive geographic space in West Germany. So throughout the lifetime of the old Federal Republic, these areas constituted a laboratory where West Germany had to wrestle in concrete ways with its ideological opponent, the GDR. And in these borderlands, Western authorities had to address the many practical consequences of partition, right? You know, interrupted roads, broken utility networks, lost property, inaccessible schools, that sort of thing. But these practical issues were only the beginning. The nature of the engagement with the socialist neighbor changed over time, reflecting the well-known trajectory of the Federal Republic from its anti-communist founding and affluent miracle years through the era of the Cold War detente into a, you know, rather self-absorbed last decade, the 1980s. When I say that the border regions were the most sensitive geographic space in West Germany, then this is, of course, related to the significance of the border itself. I mean, I probably don't need to explain that the Iron Curtain was, of course, the central icon of Cold War Europe. It was a shorthand for the partition of the continent into West and East, into capitalist and socialist economies, and NATO, Warsaw Pact, democratic and collective societies, right? So these Cold War binaries were symbolized by the Iron Curtain. And fueled by this symbolic valence and power, the border, I argue, magnified all activities and developments in these borderlands.
On that note, you begin by investigating the economic dislocations caused by this demarcation of Germany. How did the sudden appearance of the Iron Curtain change the situation on the ground? And how did locals react to this abrupt reordering of the economy?
Two chapters in my book are addressing the economic situation, the economic consequences of the inter-German border. And I find them really central to understand how West Germany ever acquired spaces that one may call borderlands at all. I mean, from an American perspective, Germany is perhaps a rather small state. And so the question is, where on earth would they fit borderlands? And in the economic chapters, I argue that the lobbying efforts of representatives from the border counties created these borderlands, constituted these borderlands. It is through the lobbying efforts that the borderlands become visible as a spatial unit. To flesh this out further, I mean, for the most part, the German Iron Curtain created borderlands where none had been before, right? So the regions along the demarcation line were economically very heterogeneous. For the most part, this border crossed the regions that were rural and dependent on agriculture, but the border also came close to cities such as Lübeck and Wolfsburg, Göttingen, Kassel, Hof, and each of them had a specific local economy or specific industries. So for a few years after the Second World War, the demarcation line between the Soviet zone and the Western zones of occupation still remained unfortified, and it was beyond the capacity or willingness of the Allied authorities to police this line in a consistent or effective manner. But although the demarcation line was still frequently crossed in both directions, East and West already began to diverge before the two German states were officially founded in 1949. So the introduction of a new currency in the Western zone of occupation in June 1948 is really central in this context because it created two territories of diverging economic opportunity, right? So that is the moment when this demarcation line really started to behave like a real border. So before Germany was divided politically, it was already getting divided economically. And in these chapters, I want to use the purge of these budding border regions to get a sense of how West Germany adjusted to its new post-war economic geography, right? So how it started to settle into the new territorial realities that were emerging after the Second World War. So in the West German context, this means that the established industrial areas on the Rhine and on the Ruhr and in Germany's southwest, they soon experienced rapid economic recovery, right? Something we conventionally call the economic miracle. But this economic miracle looked very different in the border regions, right? It actually had detrimental effects in the border counties. So as economic recovery gained momentum and on the Rhine and on the Ruhr, it sucked capital, business, and labor out of the borderlands. Local companies received relocation bids, skilled workers now migrated west, but unemployment in the border counties remained very high. So because economic recovery had these detrimental effects in the border regions, border residents began to feel that they were, you know, under friendly fire, so to speak, and they started to refer to the rest of the country as the Golden West, right, as if they themselves were not part of it. So justified or not, in the new economic geography of Western Germany, the regions along the border acquired a reputation as economically depressed areas. And justified or not, residents in these border regions perceived themselves as falling behind. And in this situation, a coalition of people from the border counties pressured the Bonn government to support their regions and prevent them from falling further behind. And I refer to these people as borderland advocates, right? They were local politicians, business owners, chamber of trade people, chamber of commerce people. And these borderland advocates argued that West German reconstruction efforts must be especially visible along the border in order to, you know, impress East German observers and demonstrate the superiority of the Western political and economic system, right? So this is the window dressing argument that we know already from West Berlin. So they argued that if their regions did not get to benefit from the economic miracle, then residents might well become susceptible to communist infiltration. So they made this argument, but hitting up the federal government in Bonn for regional aid was really a futile proposition at first. West Germany, all of West Germany, was recovering from war, so depressed regions were not exactly in short supply. In fact, the border counties only joined an already highly audible chorus of similar expectations that were directed towards the state. The border regions had a hard time for sure, but so did a whole string of other areas and cities. So clearly, there was a competition for state resources here, and the border advocates realized that they needed to speak with one voice. They needed a more systematic approach, and they therefore coordinated their efforts and started to pitch a more consistent message, right? So whereas other regions only, in quotation mark, suffered from war damages and run-of-the-mill structural weaknesses, the border regions could point to and actively enlisted the ideological parameters of the Cold War, right? So theirs were problems caused by communist aggression. So the early Cold War provided a suitable language and imagery to pitch the border regions as victimized, right, by the communist regime next door. So those who spoke for the borderlands developed a visual and rhetorical language of partition that fixed the demarcation line on the mental maps of their compatriots even before East German authorities famously escalated the border regime and locked down the demarcation line in May 1952. And so I was analyzing these lobbying efforts, and I came to the conclusion that borderland advocates really cared less about living in the shadow of the Iron Curtain than about living in the shadow of the economic miracle, right? So borderland residents were quite concerned that economic recovery was passing them by. And these lobbying efforts were eventually rewarded. I mean, state support was slow in coming, but once regional aid measures took shape, these areas came to be known in West Germany as Zonenrandgebiet, which I translate as zonal borderlands. And borderland advocates themselves had actually come up with this term. It was kind of their brand name. Although their regions were actually economically very diverse, they realized that they needed a coherent label to turn their regions into one recognizable spatial unit. And correspondingly, the aid program they eventually received came to be called Zonenrandförderung, right, which I translate as zonal borderland aid. And this aid program was designed to support the counties and the local economies through various state subsidies, you know, anything from favorable interest rates on business loans to tax incentives, transportation subsidies, you know, that sort of thing. And zonal borderland aid soon became an integral part of the border region's economic and cultural life. So together with aid to West Berlin, zonal borderland aid really became the most enduring regional aid program in West German history. I mean, that it's a terribly awkward term, Zonenrandgebiet or Zonenrandförderung. I don't know, you're probably aware that during the 50s and 60s and well beyond, West Germans referred to the GDR as die Zone, the zone. So that was clearly a mockery of socialist East Germany. And by doing that, by referring to the GDR as the zone, West Germans implied that despite the founding of an independent East German state in 1949, the GDR remained a Soviet puppet regime, right? Not much different from the times when East Germany was the Soviet zone of occupation. So referring to the West German border counties as the zonal borderland served as a reminder to federal officials that these regions were really a product of partition and that the local economies were in distress through no fault of their own. So this was a very clever brand name in many ways.
Well, more than just branding, it goes on to become part of federal law. How does the economic discussion around local conditions evolve over the course of the Cold War? And how does it reflect these anxieties? And how did those change after 1990?
Right. So the borderland advocates really had to develop a certain line of argument in order to pitch their regions. And so they argued that the economy was suffering in the border counties because of the border, right? So the Iron Curtain became causal for any sort of economic deficiencies in these regions. And they basically had to repeat this argument over and over again in order to get this regional aid program entrenched by law. And they succeeded in 1971. They succeeded, and a zonal borderland aid law got on the books, and that really made this program pretty unassailable. And to have it entrenched by law gave them equivalency to the aid that was slated for West Berlin. So this was a major success for the borderland advocates, and they wanted to keep things that way. But because so many tools, financial tools, were available for the borderlands, things not always went smoothly. There was, of course, also some abuse of these subsidies. There was a very unforeseen real estate boom, for instance. There was much construction in the Harz Mountains or along the Baltic coast with these subsidies. And basically, you know, an overcapacity for tourism was being built up. And eventually this bubble was bursting and created a bit of a scandal. And so criticism for this program was clearly forming, especially in federal states that did not benefit from this largesse. So North Rhine-Westphalia or Hamburg are cases in point. And Hamburg was particularly upset about zonal borderland aid because Hamburg itself was not covered by this program, but a few counties on the eastern side of Hamburg did benefit. So these counties suddenly had a financial advantage over Hamburg and managed to lure several factories out of Hamburg itself. And then Hamburg, as a consequence, of course, lost corporate taxes here and the jobs. So there was some tension here between those who received this and those who didn't. So in 1989, when the border fell, these states, especially Hamburg, were very quick to call for an end of zonal borderland aid. It was gone entirely by 1994. And the tools of this program, right, anything from affordable loans or transportation subsidies, infrastructural help, the tools of this program moved kind of 30 miles east into former East Germany. So the tools of the zonal borderland aid program became the tools of Aufbau Ost, Reconstruction East. That was the government program that was meant to reform the East German economy. Since there was such proximity between the former western border counties and the former eastern border counties, there were a few efforts of western companies to continue to collect the subsidies by simply, you know, moving a few miles over to the east, etc. So this led to a very uneven integration of these borderlands.
From economy and social policy, you turn to tourism, which I have to say, far and away, my favorite part of the book, but I digress. How did Germans use borderland tourism to mediate their understanding of the Cold War as it's unfolding? And how did the narratives that emerge from this engagement with the borderlands change over time?
Yeah, so really there's this curious activity of sightseeing at the Iron Curtain, right? So already in the early 50s, the inter-German border attracted curiosity seekers and eventually turned into a well-developed tourist attraction. So there was an elaborate tourist infrastructure that emerged on the western side of the inter-German border that allowed visitors to peek into East Germany from, you know, from lookout towers or to travel on the Elbe River on pleasure boats. They could stop by at information centers or they could buy colorful postcards that depicted the border fortifications. So I thought that was a very odd activity, but as I said in the opening, I myself participated in it when I was in high school. So I really tried to revisit this. And I read this sightseeing at the Iron Curtain as a way that West Germans and their visitors sought to make sense of the global Cold War through local activity. The Iron Curtain is, of course, an odd spot for tourism. It's a site of danger and death. It's a site of national tragedy. It's the Cold War front line. And a local hotel owner called the phenomenon creepy tourism. So he thought it was creepy that busloads of people would come and do this. So I thought that was a great term. Border tourism could, in fact, be quite dangerous. Border visitors frequently stepped into risky situations through ignorance, carelessness, or, you know, bravado. They you know, would throw items over the fence or shout insults at border guards, or they stepped across the demarcation line in games of daring, you know, stuff like that. But sometimes people simply didn't know where the demarcation line actually was. Here it really matters that this border was called the Iron Curtain. So people had a certain mental image. They expected a solid fence and they assumed that the borderline was where the fence stood. And that was often tragically wrong. I mean, over time, East German border authorities had moved the entire border infrastructure of the Iron Curtain further inland. So the first fence was some 50 or 100 meters beyond the actual demarcation line. So if visitors stepped up to the fence for, you know, whatever obligatory photo or whatnot, they were already well on GDR state territory. And East German guards treated that as a violation of East Germany's sovereignty. So they, you know, they might shoot at visitors or they arrested them. So a harmless Sunday outing could end rather badly. For some border visitors, however, this very danger may well have constituted the kick of a border visit. And needless to say that border tourism was a major provocation for East German authorities. The fortifications of the border, how the border looked, I mean, all of this was really forbidden knowledge for ordinary East Germans. East Germans were not allowed to approach the border, so border tourism really could only happen from the western side. And from the western side, this forbidden knowledge was deliberately put on display, right? So the Western visitors could easily see what the SED regime always sought to deny, namely that the border had been fortified to lock people in and not to keep alleged fascists or imperialists out. So border tourism was really a major image problem for the GDR leadership. I mean, not only when a violent incident happened, but really almost on a daily basis. And they reacted to that in various ways. I mean, in the 1950s and 60s, the Eastern Border Authorities experimented with various approaches on how to handle the issue. They try to make sure that villages and farms that were visible from the West would look spiffy and prosperous. At times, they actually tried to propagandize Western visitors with billboards and loudspeakers. So they would blare messages of socialism's successes. But as time went on, especially in later decades, the strategy became to pacify the border area and try to make sure that there's really nothing to see or to experience. So border visits, the intention was that border visits would become boring for Western tourists.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, the second half of the book deals with the environmental history of the borderlands and complicates some very well-established narratives about this particular area. You begin by dealing with the issue of transboundary air and water pollution. How did ecological concerns develop and shape the relationship between East and West?
Yeah, I think this chapter on pollution between East and West Germany is perhaps even my favorite one. I learned so much from writing it. Transboundary pollution is, of course, a staple topic in both environmental history and in borderland studies. But this chapter really, as you say, allowed me to develop a new perspective on inter-German relations. The relations between both sides were always tense, of course, and even after Ostpolitik, like the German version of détente, they remained, tense. So both sides fought and quibbled about every possible issue, from transit routes to West Berlin to protocol issues at international conferences, like, you know, which German representative gets to sit where and speak first, you know, all that stuff. So in these complex relations, environmental diplomacy has so far been overlooked. And in my book, I point out that the inter-German border was really the interface through which West and East Germany encountered each other's pollution. And this encounter became highly asymmetrical over time. I mean, during the 1980s, the GDR's infrastructure was in full decline, and its decaying industry was literally bleeding pollution. And those affected by this pollution were, of course, first and foremost the East Germans. But a good amount of it also ended up on the West German side, because curiously, most border crossing rivers run from east to west. So West German authorities, therefore, monitored East German pollution, and they made futile attempts to pressure the GDR to do something about it. And the issues were really serious. I mean, the mighty Elbe River that flows from Dresden towards Hamburg was polluted. Its contamination was literally off the charts. I mean, after unification in 1990, a new classification category had to be invented to describe its pollution level. And I argue in this chapter that when the West Germans monitored East German pollution, they were practically looking at the evidence of the GDR's dissolution. But they failed to decode the message, right? They didn't understand that the significant rise in pollution in the 1980s indicated that the GDR was already in full decline. And instead, they continued to negotiate with the GDR as if the East Germans still had any leverage about their own pollution levels and could have done something about it. I mean, those negotiations didn't come to anything at the time, partly because the GDR was no longer in a position to affect the decline of its infrastructure. But I also argue that these negotiations nonetheless mattered. These negotiations generated the knowledge about the causes of East German environmental problems. Much of ecological restoration after 1990 was achieved by simply switching off the polluting industries, right? So factories were closed, mines were shut down. But I still credit the environmental diplomacy of the 1980s with producing a clear understanding of the challenges and occasionally also with generating accurate templates to fix these problems. So it was very important to me to draw this whole subject beyond the year 1990 when both countries were unified. And in fact, I found it very illuminating to draw the subject matter of all my chapters well into the post-unification years and at times, you know, right into the present, as I did here with this transboundary pollution chapter.
Could you just briefly talk us through one of your case studies of this kind of cross-border interaction between the governments?
Yes. One of my case studies is the Werra River. The Werra River meanders across the border between Thuringia and Hesse. This river suffered from brines that came from potash mining. And potash mining in this region had been practiced since around 1900. So this was not a new industry in any way. And already in the early 20th century, the potash mining had created conflicts between the stakeholders of the river, farmers, people who draw their drinking water from the river, and the potash industry that was polluting it. During the Second World War, the pollution of the river already increased significantly because for the sake of the war economy, the production of potash had to be cranked up. So already at that time, the pollution of the river was standing at about 2,500 milligram of salt per liter of water. And that's just a figure for now. But basically, you yourself do not want to drink this water if it's beyond 250 milligrams, right? So we are already at a point where the water is no longer useful as drinking water, neither for humans nor for animals. During the Cold War, when Germany was divided, the East Germans, of course, continued to exploit these potash mines, and they decided to get rid of the brines by continuing to dump them into the Werra River. So they were in a way free riding on West Germany in that regard. And from the East German side, they argued that this shouldn't matter all that much because the river would just eventually discharge the water to the North Sea. So it's basically just a canal. But the West Germans, of course, had the damage from it because these aggressive brines, I mean, not only was the water no longer potable and not even useful for industrial use, but the aggressive salty brines were also damaging infrastructure along the river, you know, from boats to turbines to bridges, etc., right? So they tried to negotiate with the GDR to decrease the input of the brines. And that didn't get anywhere because, as I mentioned, the GDR was just not in a position to make investments on the scale that would have been needed to decrease the input of the pollutants. So the negotiations were very frustrating for the West German side because the East Germans basically said, well, if you want us to decrease pollution, then why don't you deliver the technology that would allow us to do it? But that was a no-go for the West Germans for a long time because they perceived this as blackmailing. So the issue didn't come to much of a solution, although over time the West Germans eventually conceded more and more because they thought if they don't do anything, then the situation will just be the same. So their own position softened over time, and they became more and more willing to provide the environmental technology to allow the East Germans to produce in a less polluting way. And when the wall fell in 1989, as I mentioned earlier, the mines on the East German side were just shut down. So that took care of a lot of the pollution. But I mean, the East Germans had never been the only polluters here. On the West German side, on the river, there were also potash mines, some of the East German mines were bought up by the Western company that ran the West German potash mines. And so after 1990, potash mining did continue in this region, and the pollution of the river does continue. And we do have a major abatement, so there are less pollutants now in the river. But at the same time, the river is still not in an ecologically good state. And the argument I make here is that only because the pollution is less after 1990 does not yet mean that the river is in a good ecological state. So in a way, the river itself that is the measure for how strong, how complicated this pollution really is. That allows you ultimately to make an argument about capitalism versus socialism. So the idea that socialism has such a negative environmental record is surely correct. But the story after 1990 does not suggest that the capitalist economy is in a better position to bring this river back to life.
I mean, the hard numbers there are extremely telling. Like, was it like 40,000 back down to 2,500, but still like 10 times higher than potable water?
That's right. That's right.
Along this line of argumentation, you also take aim at the narrative of the Iron Curtain as a conservation success story.
Yes.
Just to begin with, though, because some of our listeners won't be familiar, what is the narrative that you are in conversation with, and what do you mean by transboundary nature?
Yes. So I have a chapter that is called Transboundary Natures. And in this chapter, I analyze the ecological footprint of the Iron Curtain and the consequences of the border regime for landscape, wildlife, and humans. And as you say, some listeners might have heard about the ecological impact of the inter-German border through a post-unification project that is called the Greenbelt. Right. So when the border opened in late 1989, nature conservation groups rushed to preserve the ecologically valuable biotopes that the border had sheltered for many years. So this swath of land was rich in biodiversity, because as long as the border occupied it, it was practically taken out of circulation for any other land use, right? So no farming, no fertilizer, hardly any foot traffic, only extensive maintenance like mowing, etc. And the Greenbelt Conservation Project seeks to protect this green strip because during the time the border stood there, this area allowed sensitive plant and animal species to thrive, right? Elsewhere in West Germany, such species were often displaced by industrialized agriculture, fertilizer use, urban development, that sort of thing. So, and I think that the Greenbelt is a very impressive project, but when I started to engage with this Greenbelt project as a historian, I soon felt that its marketing story sounded just a tad too nice. The conventional Greenbelt narrative explains the biodiversity in the former border strip by referring to a 40-year respite for nature, right? A 40-year breathing space for nature. And I felt that this was too much of a redemptive narrative, right? It was kind of a from barbed wire to biodiversity kind of narrative. But if you look at the development of the actual border infrastructure, you can see that before any respite settled over the Iron Curtain, the expansion of border fortifications degraded the landscape, right? In the name of border security, eastern border troops denuded forests. They kept weeds short. And contemporaries described the border as a scar in the landscape. So that was surely not a compliment. So I wanted to know how the escalating infrastructure of the Iron Curtain affected wildlife and landscape. The Iron Curtain was, after all, a military installation with a political function. So I wanted to point out that the objectives of this border dictated how the land was managed. So I wanted to tell the story forward, if you will, and explore how the Iron Curtain changed the landscapes. And these changes differ, of course, depending on whether you look at a wetland or at a forest. And the hardware of the Iron Curtain had different consequences for birds than it had for mammals. So I hope that this chapter historicizes the Greenbelt Conservation Project by addressing these many unintended ecological consequences of the border regime.
If the bucolic idyll narrative is naive, what is, as you would argue, the correct historicization of this process?
Well, I wouldn't call it naive. Let's face it, it's a marketing narrative, right? So it has a function. It has the function to aggregate complex issues for people who are not, you know, necessarily into ecological processes. So I can see why they would pitch their project that way in order to produce buy-in for what I also consider to be an important conservation project. But I think as a historian, I simply have different questions. The Greenbelt success story is often told from 1989 forward. And I wanted to know how exactly this border changed the landscape, right? Like what exactly was it about this border that it had this effect on landscape? And the fact that it was so highly fortified was, in my view, only one part of the story. And as I mentioned, once you have to look at different biotopes to discern different consequences. So the story is, in my view, much more nuanced than many accounts of the Greenbelt have led on so far.
This is what's so interesting about this idea of a transboundary nature to me, because it's flies in the face of this idea, as you say, of like the respite for nature by highlighting that this is still a human landscape at some level, even though it's a landscape that's being cultivated, like you say, the tradition of knowing nature through work.
Yes, that line is from Richard White, of course, from his famous book about the Columbia River. So transboundary natures, I developed this concept, and what I mean with it is the landscapes that the border created. So the border here clearly has agency in how it affects landscape. And I wanted to look at not, you know, I didn't want to repeat the line that a border runs through a landscape, but I wanted to know what does this border mean for landscape. So, for instance, I looked at one particular wetland, the Drömling, which is east of Wolfsburg. This is an area that got divided by the inter-German border. And this wetland had been turned into arable land for agriculture. That was a very complicated hydrological proposition. So this land had to be drained in order to make fields arable. And so there were many, you know, ditches and draining canals, etc. And farmers would form cooperatives to keep all of this functioning, to keep up this infrastructure. And when the inter-German border came in, these cooperatives too were basically divided, and the upkeep was abandoned. So all of these canals silted and no longer functioned the way they were used to. And so the water basically now reverted to its natural courses. And so the net result was that fields on the western side were flooding again and eventually became useless for agriculture. So this went on for several years until local politicians and farmers decided that these fields would be abandoned, no longer farmed, and basically the wetland was allowed to return into its more natural state. And this I thought was a fascinating process where you could really show that the border itself and the upkeep of the border undercut other activities which then had ecological outcomes.
You conclude with the far-reaching implications of the Gorleben nuclear waste site. To begin, What were the core issues around this? How did it become such a lightning rod for anti-nuclear protests?
Yeah. So this last chapter analyzes the so-called Gorleben controversy. In 1977, the West German government announced plans to build a nuclear reprocessing and waste storage facility in a very tiny village in Gorleben, which is located right on the Elbe River. So Gorleben was really just about 2 miles away from the border. And this nuclear plant would have become West Germany's most costly industrial project to date. It was planned on the assumption that nuclear energy would allow Germany to move beyond fossil fuels and to gain proximate energy independence. So it was in Gorleben that the West Germans hoped to close the nuclear fuel cycle. I mean, that term was a fashionable expression at the time. Many countries produced nuclear energy and kind of had the front end of nuclear production figured out. But no one had a solution for the back end, namely reprocessing of used nuclear fuel and the safe forever storage of the radioactive waste products. And frankly, I mean, it's almost 2020 and still no one has a terminal waste storage facility, but that's a different conversation. But anyway, a project of this magnitude was dropped into the borderlands in 1977 by nominating Gorleben as the site for the nuclear facility. Government officials really turned a borderland location into the linchpin of West Germany's future energy supply. I mean, at least as it was conceived in the mid-1970s. So this chapter really allows me to show one more time how the proximity of the border magnified any issues and developments that unfolded in its vicinity, right? So I argue that the presence of the border shaped and magnified every aspect of the Gorleben siting controversy.
So what was that controversy? There's this perfect storm of governments, activists, lobbyists, industry, diplomacy, foreign influence, all coming together inter-German influence. I'm not sure what the right way to characterize it. But all of these threads coming together in this issue, what happened?
Well, I mean, because of this borderland location, if you are building a major nuclear facility right under the nose of your neighbor, I mean, inevitably, this did draw the GDR into the debate about Gorleben. But Gorleben already was a raging political controversy in the Federal Republic because this project was announced in 1977 at a time when anti-nuclear protest was already running high. To have the GDR in the mix was really a bad scenario for the government of Chancellor Helmut Schmidt. They were already conducting environmental diplomacy with the GDR on other issues, for instance, the River Werra River, and that obviously wasn't much fun. So in view of the known inclinations of the SED regime to use West German problems and predicaments as leverage for material compensation, the federal government dreaded lengthy negotiations with the GDR about this nuclear facility, because this would endow East Berlin with influence over a sensitive policy initiative. But I mean, to this day, there's really the persistent claim by contemporaries and also in the literature that the GDR did not protest the Gorleben project. And I thought that was really odd because it would have been completely out of character in view of the customary East German behavior in matters far more minor than a huge nuclear facility on their state border, right? So I'm not going to spell all of this out, but suffice it to say that the GDR did protest the facility, but this protest remained mostly in diplomatic channels. What fascinated me was that the SED leadership was surprisingly well informed about every aspect of the Gorleben project. They relied on Stasi information, and they really did not wait until the Bonn government would share any information with them. So I found almost verbatim parallels between protocols from the West German nuclear cabinet meetings and in Stasi reports. So they were really exquisitely well informed. And so the SED leadership objected in particular to the reprocessing plant because the location of Gorleben and the climatic conditions were likely to settle the East Germans with the risks of this proposed nuclear facility. So if there ever had been an accident, the fallout would have drifted over East German territory. So needless to say that they were concerned about that. So that is one aspect of the perfect storm. And what's also interesting in terms of the borderland subsidy story that I had mapped out in the first chapters, this Gorleben siding decision really almost consummated decades of lobby work by borderland advocates. So there were these discursive patterns that had been conceived in the 1950s that framed the border regions as areas in need of state aid, in need of industrial development and jobs. So in a way, the borderland location of Gorleben almost predetermined its nomination. And there's this long-standing debate in German politics whether Gorleben was selected for geological reasons, right? It had a suitable salt dome, or whether it was selected for structural reasons because the region needed jobs. And since my earlier chapters established that the borderlands had been constructed as a spatial unit based on economic concerns and regional interest politics, there is, in my view, really no other possible answer. Gorleben was picked for structural reasons. After three decades of lobbying, borderland advocates had really contributed significantly to the perception that their regions would gladly accept any industrial development, including risk industries. And the elected officials of the county where Gorleben is located were open to the idea to transform their county into a nuclear community, right? So the nuclear risk they agreed to house was made to be more bearable by affluence, right? By material incentives. So local leaders hope to finally catch up with the prosperity that they perceived in the rest of the republic. So this entire episode remains surprisingly close to the borderland rhetoric of the 1950s. Gorleben really continued the anti-nuclear activism that was already going on in the Federal Republic at that time. And I argue that the border influenced the very way that the anti-Gorleben protest movement unfolded and was composed. So you have to see that this was Gorleben was located in a very rural area. In the early 1970s, people from, you know, Hamburg, West Berlin, Göttingen moved to this county because it was so secluded, because modernization had passed it by. Gorleben, the Wendland area where Gorleben was located, was perceived as, you know, to have retained a certain rural authenticity, etc. So people settled there who tried to use the area to practice, you know, what we could call alternative lifestyles. So the seclusion that the border created had drawn them there in the first place. And now that they were there, suddenly are these plans to nuclearize this particular county. And what the protesters did is that they continued the tradition of really spectacular grassroots activism and spectacular activities. So, for instance, there was the famous Gorleben Trek where farmers would drive their tractor trailers all the way to Hanover, to the state capital of Lower Saxony, to protest the Gorleben plans. There was also the occupation of the construction site and the founding of the Free Republic Wendland, right? I mean, they basically staged a departure from what they perceived to be the atomic state. But most interesting is really how they involved the border itself in their protest. The border provided rather spectacular protest opportunities that would allow them to generate media attention. So on two occasions, protesters actually crossed the demarcation line onto GDR territory to stage a demonstration. They squatted on GDR territory, and that put them out of reach of Western authorities. And surely this was also against the rules of the Eastern border authorities. And so they practically invented a new protest form that was only possible in divided Germany, right? You occupy the border strip, you're flirting with a Cold War incident. And this protest form was subsequently adapted for a number of other environmental causes. The border fortifications would serve as a backdrop for protest activities that wanted to underscore the point that, that pollution or nuclear radiation simply knew no boundaries. So what better place to do that than the allegedly solid Iron Curtain?
Projects like this always end up opening innumerable rabbit holes that you can fall down, and sometimes you have to just move on from them. In writing it, though, in writing this book, were there any questions that are still niggling at you that you think you're going to deal with in the future or that you feel deserve further investigation by others in the field?
I think that the Greenbelt project is quite likely to attract further attention. This is a project of such a magnitude. This is, you know, a major, the kind of the flagship project of German nature conservation at this time. So I think there will be future readings of the meaning of this conservation project. And I also think we are not done with the conversation about the environmental record of state socialism as compared to the environmental record of the capitalist economies. So I think that conversation is being very cautiously reopened right now by scholars of Eastern Europe. So I'm looking forward to seeing that develop further. And well, I do regret that I never wrote a chapter on the borderlands as military spaces. Of course, this was also the military front line of the Cold War, and the military strategies of both NATO and Warsaw Pact centered on this particular area. So I had intended to have a chapter about this, but the project was really growing too large. And so eventually that ended up on the chopping block. So I wouldn't mind if somebody would pick that up.
Well, the best books always seem to raise more questions than they answer. So we look forward to your future work. But thank you very much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that does it for us here at New Books in German Studies. We've been speaking with Astrid Eckert about her new book, West Germany and the Iron Curtain, Environment, Economy, and Culture in the Borderlands. Astrid's book is the first environmental history of the German borderlands with a fascinating perspective on how the Iron Curtain shaped economics and culture in the Federal Republic. For those of you interested in a history of the internal border that examines these broader knock-on effects of a militarized frontier, you can get your copy of West Germany and the Iron Curtain from Oxford University Press as of 2019. Astrid Eckert is required reading to nuance many of the traditional narratives of post-war German historiography, and as fascinating on the page as she is in conversation. With that, I'd like to thank you for joining us today, and hope to see you next time.